I'm Gabe Ortiz, afternoon host at WIPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make the live streams like this one more difficult to maintain. Stand up for public media and help fortify WIPR's future. Find out more and donate at WIPR.org. Thank you.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, guest host John Lee, who covers Baltimore County for the WIPR news team, will speak with Kelly Madigan, the Baltimore County Inspector General, about her future in her role as the county's watchdog. So that's coming up tomorrow. And now, a conversation with Earl Arnett, who has written a poignant, loving memoir about his long love affair with Baltimore's First Lady of Jazz, the iconic singer Ethel Ennis. Here's Ethel singing My Foolish Heart in a recording from 1957.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic. Oh, a kiss.
Oh, there is a lady who knows how to deliver a song. Earl Arnett joins me in Studio B to talk about his new book, A Jazz Romance, Ethel Ennis, Baltimore, and Me. It's great to see you, Earl.
Tom, I feel like I'm at home because you and I have known each other for such a long time.
Long time.
Indeed. We haven't seen each other in a long time, so I'm delighted to be here.
Well, me too. I'm glad to have you. Talk about how you first met Ethel Ennis. You were in the audience in the beginning of your, understanding that she existed.
Huh? It's a saga. I first came to Baltimore, I guess, in 1962 when I was a student at the Army Intelligence School. And one of the students said, there's this great singer in a little place called the Red Fox. Let's go there. So we went there, and at the time they said, she's married to a Baltimore lawyer. She sings on the weekend. I was bowled over, but then I went to California and forgot all about it. But I came back to Baltimore and became a police reporter in 1966. And I met Ethel in March of 67 because I was going to write a story about her.
Yeah.
I never wrote the story. We got married in August.
Yeah. You met in March. You got married in August. Yeah. And 1967 was the year that the Supreme Court decided their very famous case, Loving versus Virginia.
Which
struck down the anti-miscegenation laws in Virginia.
And a number of other states as well. There were about 15 or 16 states. Yeah.
So, I mean, how did your families react to the fact that here's a white guy marrying a black girl?
Well, you know, in the book, one of the things I had to debate, my father, who was at the time a retired lieutenant colonel in the military, because I come from a military family, I figured no problem because we'd lived all over the world. We were used to having all kinds of people at home. Ethel looked at me a little askance and said, well, we'll see. Well, sure enough, when this word got out, my father reverted to a lieutenant colonel, to a Kentucky colonel, and he wrote me a manifesto, 11 typewritten pages, which I duplicate in the book, telling me why marriage was wrong. And I was astonished. It took him 9 years to adjust to our marriage. My mother was mortified. My brother and sister were embarrassed. Ethel's family, her father, said, well, you know, I believe in universal humanity, no problem. Her mother said, well, if you're going to marry a white man, why ain't he rich?
Oh, that.
Yeah, the era.
And you write that Ethel had neither the temperament nor the boldness to fight segregation openly. And her audiences were a mixture of black, white, young, old, straight, gay. I mean, they were all over the map. You know? So it wasn't like she was a crusader.
No. Her mother was more of a crusader than Ethel. Ethel always remembered going downtown in the 50s to a department store. In those days, you know, if you were black, you had to go to the bathroom first because there was no place for you to do that downtown. Well, the poor little girl Ethel had to go. Her mother stormed right through the white-only bathroom, and no one bothered her. But Ethel didn't have that kind of temperament.
When it comes to music, you write that she was a church girl who stumbled into professional music.
That's true.
Her career really is kind of sui generis, isn't it? I mean, it's very unlike virtually any other career.
She is a very unusual period. It's one of the things that attracted me to her. I had never met such a talented person who was so natural and who just sort of came by it naturally. She blossomed. She always said she wanted to blossom where she was planted, and that's what she did. And she was planted in the Gilmore Homes in Sandtown, Winchester, not the place where you would expect to find a great, sophisticated, jazzy singer. I always compared her singer to cognac and champagne, you know.
So how did she? She moved from the church to the concert stage and the clubs and singing jazz and pop music and singing a whole range of things. How did that happen?
Well, she was playing piano for the Sunday school as a teenager. And then when she was about 15, a group of guys got together to form a bebop band, and they needed a piano player. Well, Ethel could play piano, and so they went to her mother and grandmother and said, can she be a part of our group? Well, I'm surprised in a way that those two ladies gave the permission, because they were very strict church folks, you know, jazz and blues, that belonged to the devil. But they gave permission, and so Ethel became the only female piano player in this all-male group, and she was just playing piano. One day, the group was playing outside of town because of her age, so it wouldn't be questioned, and someone requested an old blues tune by Ruth Brown called In the Dark, and Ethel happened to know it because in the projects, she and her brother had been listening downstairs Miss Gertrude, and Miss Gertrude would have Saturday night fish fries, and the blues would be boom, da boom, da boom. Well, she knew the song. She sang the song. They got a big tip. Light bulb went off, and Ethel said, well, maybe I could hang my shingle out as a singer. That's how that all started.
Yeah. Literally stumbled into
it.
Earl Arnett, the new book is called A Jazz Romance, Ethel Ennis, Baltimore, and Me. If you have a question for Earl Arnett, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You mentioned that you grew up as a military kid, lived all over the world. You're in Japan during high school and stuff, and then, you know, all that. Ethel, I think she wrote this tune, Since I've Been to You. Is that a tune?
No,
that's
not an Ethel tune.
Okay.
That's an old standard.
Okay, it's a standard. All right, because I wasn't familiar until I heard Ethel sing it. But here's an album that she, this is a tune called Since I've Been to You from 1964.
Well, here I am to tell you, it's true, I just blew in. There's not one place in this old world where I've not been. I've been to Mexicali, been to Bally Bally. There are like some back alleys since I've been to you. I really like to travel. Dig the sights, like warm Italian afternoons and Spanish nights. I've been to Yokohama, been to see the llama, but there's no more drama since I've been to you. I had never been to arms that felt so strong. I had never been to eyes so blue. I had never been to lips and stayed so long.
Ethel Ennis singing Since I've Been to You from the album Once Again. You guys toured the world. You were all over the place. And you were also inseparable. You you went with Ethel as she performed.
As much as I could.
Here, there, and everywhere. But you were working for the Sun, too, for a good bit of that time.
I had a job with the Sun that gave me a lot of flexibility. As long as I wrote three stories a week about pretty much what I wanted to write about, they let me be free, really. So if Ethel went to Spokane, Washington to sing, I would go to Spokane and write about the Spokane Indians. Or if she went down to Miami, I would figure out a way to write about spring training by the Orioles, you know. So, and then when I left the Sun, of course, we decided we never wanted to be apart. So we were inseparable. We were joined at the hip, so to speak, 24/7.
24/7, and what a great, great partnership. You know, when it came to Ethel's career, you write that RCA, the record label she recorded for, never found the hit that might have moved Ethel into that kind of upper echelon of the entertainment business. You know, people actually made a whole lot of money and big houses and all that kind of stuff. You know, a lot of those artists had the song. You know, Tony Bennett had I Left My Heart in San Francisco, et cetera. Why do you think that was? I mean, it could have partly been because Ethel's taste was so eclectic and she was so good at so many different things.
I think that's part of it. I think timing was part of it. From a music career point of view, Ethel's timing was terrible because she was always coming in at the end of something, you know, and her style of singing was going out of style even when she was beginning in the 60s, you know. Rock and roll had taken over, jazz-oriented singers were declining, so she never quite fit. Plus, she was like Ellington's uncategorizable, you know. She didn't fit categories. She didn't want to be categorized. She just wanted to sing. Well, that I'm surprised in a way that she had a career in the entertainment business because, you know, it's very competitive and people struggle and strive. Ethel just
Wasn't her style.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah,
it was wonderful for me.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And one of the great honors of my life was getting to know you and Ethel, and even working with Ethel on a few little gigs together over the years. She was just, you know, she had such a she was calm. She was, you know.
And we always admired what you did with the Choral Arts Society.
Yeah, well, we had a good time together. But, you know, and Ethel passed away. She was 86 years old back in 2019. I mean, it's been a while.
6 years ago. Yeah.
6 years. It's interesting because I think there's a lot of people think when they think about jazz and Baltimore icons, they think about Billie Holiday, who did spend a lot of time here. But Ethel, I mean, you and Ethel moved into a house on Layton Avenue, I don't know how many years ago, 150?
Almost 60. Almost 60.
You know, and stayed put. I mean, you know, and but she, you know, launched that. She was on the Mike Douglas show, the Johnny Carson show. She, you know, all the.
A lot of people never realized just how extensive her musical activities were.
Yeah.
Because we lived very modestly and very quietly in our little house, and we used to tell people we give parties, but we don't invite anybody.
Well, one of the places that you gave a lot of great parties was a place called Ethel's Place.
That's true.
A club that you all opened. It's right downtown, across the street from Symphony Hall, right where the theater project is in that same building. Tell us about that. Endeavor.
That really encompasses almost a whole decade for us because in 1980, I left the Sun and we started getting involved more in music. And she was singing down in Annapolis. A man named Paul Pearson established the Marilyn Inn down there, and Ethel and Charlie Bird were the mainstays of that musical establishment. A little bald-head doctor walked in once and said, well, you know, I got $1 million. I'd like to build a club around Ethel. I didn't pay attention to him. I figured this guy's nuts, you know. He said that a couple times, and sure enough, I found out, well, he had $1 million, and so I started looking at downtown locations for a place that could be an Ethel's place, so to speak. It took 4 years. He got out of the picture. Phil Arnault from the Theater Project got in the picture. Then Bill Strever got in the picture.
He's a developer in town, right?
Finally, after 4 years, it was there. It was something unusual in America, and particularly, I think, in Baltimore, because it was a complex. It wasn't just a music nightclub, so to speak. It was a performance space. It was a restaurant. There were two bars. It really was more European in sort of scope and definition.
Yeah, there was an upstairs and a downstairs.
Right. And I got involved in it because I thought Ethel needed a music home, a space where people could come and where her peers could come. And so musically speaking, it worked out very well. People came from all over, world-famous performers, many of whom knew Ethel and admired her. I never had to worry about finding people to play there. You know, I was fielding the phone from all over for people who wanted to play there.
Sure.
You know, Dizzy Gillespie said it was the best jazz club he'd ever been in, you know. So it lasted 4 years, I guess. We had maybe 1,000 performers of all different kinds, you know, even symphony performers. Yo-Yo Ma came across the street once with some players from the orchestra to perform Mendelssohn's octet. We did a lot of interesting things like that.
Yeah. But boy, running a club is...
it drove us nuts.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you're right about the financial burden of that. Financially, all we ever received from the project were court judgments for personally guaranteed lines of credit, inflated IRS bills, and my eventual personal bankruptcy.
That's true.
I mean, it's rough.
That's true. When we finally sold Ethel's place, we had bills, and I discovered that when the IRS got involved, all the lawyers and accountants associated with the project headed for the hills.
Yeah.
And I was left there, so I fell on my sword, and took us a long time to recover from that.
But it was a great place. I moved here in 1982, so it opened shortly thereafter.
Right.
And whenever we would work at Symphony Hall, right across the street, we'd always go to Ethel's place for, you know, a drink and see what was going on afterwards. It was just a great spot. Your travels also led you to meet all sorts of people. Politicians, you're in the White House with President Nixon. You knew all sorts of people because I think Ethel was a real magnet to that. I mean, the two of you as a couple were a magnet for all that.
Ethel attracted all kinds of people because she was so universal in her attitude. Whether you were old or young or gay or straight or black or white, whatever you were, she approached you as if you were a very special person. And so we did go up and down the social scale. I always said that you know, you have to think from the White House to the street corner in order to really build community, and that's what we did.
In terms of her legacy, in terms of how she is remembered, I mean, clearly you remember her with such love, and you were married for 52 years. And you know what an incredible partnership it was. Are you satisfied with how Ethel's place in history is being forged now in the years following her passing?
I think that's yet to be determined. I'm very happy with what the Sheridan Libraries at Johns Hopkins have done with her memory. They helped us create a memorial concert when she died. They had a special exhibit at Peabody that lasted for several months. They helped with the publication of this book. So I couldn't be more pleased that she was recognized in her hometown. Hopkins gave her an honorary degree in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And Ethel just took such things as a matter of course, but I was very proud of her.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know, she did a lot to make you proud.
Yeah.
And all of us proud here in Baltimore if we like music and we like jazz. How do you assess the current jazz scene? We have two clubs that come to mind. I mean, we have Keystone Corner downtown in Harbor East, and we have Andy Music. There's going to be a big book launch for this book at Andy Music on Saturday afternoon.
On Saturday, yeah.
I mean, what you know, as a you've been in the impresario side, you've been on the traveling, you know, gig side. You've seen it from all sides. How do you assess it in our city now?
That's hard to say. I don't think there aren't nearly as many venues now as there used to be.
Yeah.
Small clubs where small groups can get a start and play. Baltimore's music scene is very strange, as I'm sure you're probably familiar with.
You know? A little bit, yeah.
And it's very eclectic. I mean, there is a music scene. I mean, Baltimore is distinctive from New Orleans or New York or Detroit. Ethel and I always thought that if we could ever bottle that distinctiveness, we could have turned Baltimore into a music center for production, you know? But when that never happened.
Yeah.
I think the scene is probably where the city is. I think we've reached a kind of low point, and I get the feeling that there's a lot bubbling now. There's a lot going on in the arts and in the music and that we haven't even seen yet. So that would make me optimistic.
Yeah, I share that optimism. Yeah. And I share a love for this book. This is a lovely story, and I miss her. And it was just great, you know, thinking back to my interactions with her and our working together. So thank you so much, and good luck with it.
It's good to see you, Tom.
Great to see you. Earl Arnett, the new book is called A Jazz Romance, Ethel Ennis, Baltimore, and Me. And as I mentioned, the official launch of the book is on Saturday afternoon at one of our city's great jazz venues, Andy Musique. Earl will talk about the book, and Shireen Wade will sing some songs that Ethel loved to sing. That begins at 2 o'clock. And up next, what do John Wilkes Booth, Mad Men, and The Sopranos have in common? Our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will explain when she joins me after a quick break. And as we go to break, here's another taste of the great Ethel Ennis. This is I've Only Got Eyes for You, released back in 1956.
Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright, for I only have eyes for you, dear. The moon is high, but I can't see a thing in the sky, 'cause I only have eyes for you. I don't know if we're in a garden.
Can I? 'Cause I'd love to show.
On a crowded avenue, for you are here, so am I. And maybe millions of.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.